Okay, I was born in Melbourne on the 19th of November 1924 and went to school in Thornbury and in Northcote High School. Then joined the Postmaster General's Department. In those days, it was the Depression period, and there was a great feeling that to be safe, you should get into some sort of public service type life. So although I had ideas on a profession, the advice was get into the public service. So I did the telegraph messenger's examination and got appointed as a telegraph messenger. Then there was another examination in those days, I think it was called for entry to the 3rd Division, and I became a clerk in the Postmaster General's Department in Melbourne in the stores branch. And then, of course, the war had come along and I was interested. I joined the Air Training Corps and spent some enjoyable days with the Air Training Corps, although my first experience of flying down at Sale in a ferry battle wasn't too exciting because they were doing gunnery-type attacks and very quick movements. And I was a little still on that and I was a bit worried then, but never mind. But in those days, by that time, this is 1942 period, there was an excess of air crew, and it wasn't long after that Britain said, we've got all the Australian air crew we need now. So there was delay, and I couldn't get into the Air Force when I turned 18 in 1942. I had to wait until April 43 and joined the Air Force as an air crew trainee, went through the usual thing of by train from Melbourne up to Sydney to go to Bradfield Park Initial Training School, then to Narendra for elementary flying training, then to Uran Quinty near Wagga for service flying training, then to Mildura for the OSTU, which was on Kitty Hawks, and then to my utter horror, I was told, no, I had to go and do some other flying. They didn't need us in the squadrons. So I ended up at Maryborough flying wireless air gunner trainees around to get some air experience and using their radios. Half of the day, the other half was driving the same trainees around in the back of Ford panel vans, where they also operated radios around the that area. And the next step was a course at the Neuquin, which had the unofficial title of the Scrub School. But again, it was a course to weed out numbers. But I was successful there, ended back at OTU at Williamtown, then up to 77 Squadron in the Halmahera's at Moratai, very close to the end of the war. I didn't serve on any operations at Moratai, but I joined 77 Squadron on Kitty Hawks. And then over to the invasion of Borneo, and we landed at Labuan Island. I didn't fly over, I went in an American landing ship tank, LST as they call them, and had to wade ashore on the island at Labuan, and then got into operations there. But it was towards the end of the war. One experience I remember well was flying over a prison camp where there were Australians, whilst our army went in to release these people from the prison camp. And they had a sign on the roof of this prison camp, which was something like, you know, get your finger out, or words to that effect, come and release us, in other words. And then the end of the war came along, and at that stage we went from our Kitty Hawks to Mustangs. The Australian fighter squadrons had been transferring to Mustangs. So it was a conversion to Mustangs at Labuan Island. Then the occupation of Japan came along, and those of us who were interested in staying in the Air Force volunteered for the occupation force. And we were a mixed bunch, some youngsters like me who hadn't seen much, and some pretty rugged old-timers who didn't want to ever let go of the Air Force. But we went to Japan in early 46, landed originally at a place called Bofu, where, among other things, we saw a small earthquake to the stage where it was a wooden building and they had 44-gallon drums full of water along the corridors for firework, and about a foot of water slopped out of each of those tanks, but no serious damage. And then as the occupation went on, I got interested in doing some, or got involved in some interesting things. One was to help supervise the first Japanese elections. And I had a car, and a driver and an interpreter, and went around and toured all the election spots, supposedly to make sure that there was no pressure being brought on the people, but what we saw seemed to be all very fair. And by that stage, the occupation force started to wind down. The Indian Air Force had gone home, the RAF had gone home. Bofu was overcrowded, so we moved to another Japanese spot, Iwakuni, a bit further east, but still on the inland sea. And the New Zealanders moved down to Bofu. It was enjoyable flying the Mustang. The next step was a trip up to Tokyo with a bunch of airmen to take part in what was called the Tokyo Guard. It was a matter of showing the flag, I suppose, and the Australian Army battalions went up in rotation, spent a month in Tokyo, putting on guards around the Imperial Palace and such places. And I had what amounted to a company of airmen to go with one of the army battalions. And that's where I met my wife. She was living in Tokyo with her parents. Her mother was Australian, her stepfather was American. And we met there. And then about 6 months later, I did another Tokyo guard. And we got engaged. And were married up there in 1950, January 50. Not long afterwards, it was time to go home. The occupation was wound up, and we went back to Melbourne, and I went to the Citizen Air Force Squadron, number 21 Squadron in Laverton, where I enjoyed flying again. There were some pretty experienced pilots there who were hanging on in the Air Force, and enjoyed flying with them. And I was then posted to Sale to undergo the flying instructor's course. And on arrival down at Sale, I left my wife home temporarily because we're in the process of trying to build a house in Melbourne. I was met by the orderly officer who I knew very well. He said, "You're posted." And I said, in effect, "Yeah, that's why I'm here." He said, "No, you're not. You're posted back to Japan for the Korean War," which I'd never heard of. So 3 days later, I was on my way back to Japan to join 77 Squadron again for the Korean War. And we got there only a week after the war started. There were 12 more pilots and 26 more experienced airmen went up. And there I was for the next 9 months, flying out of Japan originally, and then on Korea itself. I managed to survive that. Got home, and unlike the sorts of thing that happens these days when people come back from war, there was no publicity, no nothing. My wife met me at the airport, and that was that. And this time I was posted to what was called ARDU, the Aircraft Research and Development Unit at Laverton, to undergo an Australian test pilot's course with three other fellows. And that was an interesting experience too, just for interest. One of the instructors was the then squadron leader, Jim Rowlands, who later became the governor of New South Wales and chief of the SR. And was proceeding along doing some minor test flying at Laverton, picking up new Mustangs from the factory at Fisherman's Bend and things like that, when I was asked to go to Woomera to take on the test flying of the Jindavik Piker aircraft project. Piker was a piloted version of the Jindavik pilotless aircraft. And that was a pretty exciting experience too. So wife and by this time child were up in Woomera in the area that's got into some disrepute in more recent times, but we found to be a livable place. where we had tennis courts and shops and quite comfortable life. Another child was born up there whilst we were at Woomera, and I spent some 2.5 years there. And we were able to get down to Adelaide for an annual holiday. Then from Woomera I was posted to America to be an exchange pilot with the American Air Force. And there were some interesting aspects of that I could enlarge on, but I won't bother now. But it was flying originally the F-86F, the American Sabre, for about the first 6 months or so. Then it was the new F-100 American aircraft, which I then transferred to. And the Americans were very good. They gave me appointment as operations officer in the squadron. And then it was back to Australia for more routine work. I formed the reformed number 3 squadron, which was getting its Sabres. They were the first Australian Sabre squadron. So I flew with them there, introducing the Sabre. Then it was the RAF Staff College down at Point Cook, a 1 year college. And then from college was into, firstly, Victoria Barracks down in Melbourne as a staff officer working on personnel. Then we moved to Canberra in 1959 and worked there for another year and a half. And then out of the blue, I was asked to do a French language course down at Point Cook and got involved in the procurement of the new Mirage aircraft from France, which a team had been over to select. And away I went by myself this time again for 4.5 months in France, learning to fly the Mirage and all its aspects. Then back to Williamtown. Was originally going to be 75 Squadron. I was posted as CO of 75 Squadron, but by the time we got back, they'd changed their minds and we were the OCU, the Operational Conversion Unit. So I flew the Mirage there and we taught the other pilots from the F-86 squadrons to fly the Mirage. Let's see, time goes by, doesn't it? Then it was... back into the personnel world, yes, in the Department of Air. Then, having had a year or so of that, I was posted as the air attaché to France. Spent 2 years in France, which was an enjoyable period. We made good friends over there, not only among the French people, but also some of the other foreign attachés. Some contacts we still have. And that was the start of a long period of 6 years overseas, which had an impact on the family, particularly the children growing up. Well, this time we had 4 children at school. We were able to take the girls with us. And as I remember, they were fluent in French after about 6 weeks. But from France, it was back to Butterworth in Malaysia to be the what was called the operations officer. Forgotten now. It used to be called the Wing Commander and the wing was disposed of. But I was 2IC on the base. 3 years of that, thinking, well, that's it, this time we'll get home. We used to be able to get the kids up for holidays. But no, I was posted in 1972 to the Royal College of Defence Studies in London. So I had a year in London on the Royal College of Defence Studies. And then back to Australia and into the operations world, deputy chief of operation, and eventually became deputy chief of air staff in 79, 80, 81, and I retired on age, the retiring age in those days still is, I think, 57 for an air vice marshal, and we retired to Canberra. And then I worked for about 4 or 5 years for the Department of Veterans Affairs in the appeals board for veterans who didn't get what they wanted. And then we decided to move north. We'd got sick of the cold in Canberra and moved up to the Tweed area and have been here now for 15 years.
That was perfect. That was very well done. We're just going to pause there for a second. So going right back to the beginning, talking about your childhood, tell me a little bit about your father.
Yes, my father was orphaned as a very young child, had a stepmother, so he had a largest family of associated people. Some of them were called Bone, and he, as a young man, got into horse driving and apparently became a capable person, although he was brought up in the city of Melbourne, capable person driving teams of horses. And he worked on around Victoria, out in the west, and also got involved in dam building. I can't think of the names of some of the dams now, but he got involved in those. And then I think he met my mother and started working for what used to be called the Fred Walker Cheese Company in Melbourne, which later became Kraft Cheese. And he spent the rest of his working life with Kraft Cheese in Melbourne. I had just one brother, and we lived in Thornbury, as I'd mentioned earlier, in some years. Dad got into bowls as he got older. We used to visit a lot of relatives, including my mother's sister and her husband, who lived up at Staghorn Flat out of Wodonga in up in the New South Wales border almost. Had a lot of visits up there.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I just had one brother, yeah, 2 years younger than me.
What was your relationship like with him?
Oh, fine, yeah. Yeah, we still communicate. He still lives in Melbourne.
And tell me what the area you grew up in, sort of in those early years, was like as at the time.
We lived in a tiny little street called Francis Grove in Thornbury that was opposite the Whale Street State School. And I think there were 16 houses in the street. They all became friends. It was interesting. There was a lovely old lady at number one called Gran Cullen. We all called her Gran. The next house, number three, was a friend of mine, Rex Vag, who I spent a lot of time with. We were great buddies. He also joined the Air Force and unfortunately was lost during the war. I didn't know the story too well, but he was shot down as part of a crew of an RAF aeroplane over Hue, H-U-E. In Vietnam during World War II. I didn't know the RAF were out there even. But some people called Seabeck were up at number five, I think, and I saw one of the Seabeck, there were two daughters, one of the Seabeck girls at Mildura only a year or so ago when I was invited over to attend a ceremony over there. And good friends. Right opposite was a lady called Ma Stick, she was always Ma, who was a nursing sister, and by that stage had semi-retired, but she was running a sort of a little care place there at her home. And there was a tennis court there, and it was a nice little settlement.
And what sort of a suburb was, or sort of area, I guess, was Thornbury?
Thornbury's working class, really.
What was the physical environment of the area like?
Not too bad. In those days, only less than a mile away, going over towards Ivanhoe, there were flats unbuilt on, creek running through. I'd been down there as a kid catching tadpoles and things like that. So it was not a bad area.
And what sort of things would you get up to as a kid with the kids that you played with in the street?
Oh dear, now you want to hear some things. Well, Rex Fagg and I got up to mischief several times. On one occasion, we decided we'd like to find out how to make gunpowder. And we found out that you needed sulfur. Oh dear. Can't think of what the other one was now. Never mind, there were three items. And after blending them for a while, we found we had an explosive mixture. And Rex Varick's father had an old shotgun with a flintlock igniter for the thing. So we found we could put some of our own gunpowder down the barrel of this shotgun and put a little cap that kids used in cap guns in those days in to ignite the thing. And we were doing some shooting with it until one day we were ramming the powder down and the wad on top of it as you had to make it go. And the darn thing exploded and the rod went through poor old Grand Cullen's fence. So we got into a bit of a bother about that one. And then later on, Rex and I were out riding our bikes around and we found some money on the side of the street. So we shot around to the local shops and bought up some firecrackers because it was firecracker night coming up. And then Rex's father and my father grabbed the crackers and took them back to the shop and got the money back, because what had happened was the milkman had come around, and in those days milkmen came around and you left your billy out and they poured the milk into the billy for you. And Grand Cullen had put her money in the billy for the week, and the milkie hadn't noticed it and just tipped it out on the street. So we had to get the money back for the milkman. But far from that, there was all sorts of things. Horse riding, we used to go over to Ivanhoe, and it was cheap to hire horses in those days. We'd go riding or swimming or canoeing on the river near Ivanhoe, which was only 2 or 3 miles away. Skating became a big thing. Originally, roller skating in first of all on the street where we lived on Francis Grove. Then we found you could do much better if you bolted your skates to a pair of old boots, so we did that. Then we were skating down at the exhibition building down towards Melbourne. And then that got a bit dull. We went on to ice skating. And we're ice skating at was the Glaciarium just across the river from the town of Melbourne. And that was fun. And then it was down to the St. Moritz, I think it was, the ice skating rink down past, down further down. And enjoyable activities. And camping.
Where would you go camping?
Up out of Melbourne. I can't think of the name of the place now, but it was about 20-odd miles out of Melbourne. And we could go up and take our own food and fishing and that sort of thing. Groups of five or six of us. So we had busy lives.
And what did you think of school at primary school age?
Yes, I got on quite well. I can remember that we held our teachers in great respect. Never heard them referred to other than Miss So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so. I enjoyed school. I tied with another old chum, a chap called Vern Watson, in fourth year at primary school. And the headmaster invited us both in to give us a verbal test, I think, to say, well, right, which one of you is going to be ducks of the class? And I thought Vernon won. So I was congratulating him, and the headmaster said, no, that's all right. So he made us both ducks of the class. So I got on fairly well at school, and no trouble reading the required standard in those days for high school.
And you mentioned that it was Depression time. What ways did the Depression affect your family?
Although my father was never out of work, he was always employed in those days. Like most women, my mother didn't work. So we found, apparently, the going a bit tough. And at one stage, our house was divided into two, and we had tenants come in and use part of the house in order to make enough money to live comfortably. That went on for 2 or 3 years. My brother and I, in fact, slept out on the front veranda, in behind screens, but on the front veranda.
Was that a little cold?
In hindsight, I don't remember it being cold, but it must have been at times. But it was a necessity of the days.
And what would your parents tell you about why they needed to divide up the house? Or
just as simple as that, we need the money. Mm.
And what sort of things did you notice around the general area of the way the Depression was affecting people?
Not too much. There was not much in the way of social activity, if I can put it that way. People just didn't have the money to socialise, or occasionally Rex and I'd go to one of the local movie theatres, and that was about the end of it. So there wasn't much spare cash around.
Would you see anyone obviously sort of on the road looking for work, sort of?
Occasionally we'd get someone come by seeking money or food or something, but not often, no.
And do you have memories, apart from obviously dividing up the house, or ways that, like, for example, with food or clothes, that your mother would try and save money and
I can remember at one stage a particular sort of raincoat had become popular, and I sought a raincoat. And the answer was, sorry, can't do that.
What was the raincoat like?
Oh, it was pretty ordinary, I suppose, in these days. It was dark, just a waterproof raincoat. Later on, when I started high school, the high school was, I don't know, off the top of my head now, 10 kilometres away. And originally I used to walk down to the main road going through the Northcote Thornbury area called High Street, a good 10-minute walk down, catch the tram up to the top of the hill in Northcote, then walk down another kilometre to the high school. And then I started to agitate for a bike so I could ride to school. And I had my eyes on some prestige bike of the day or something. And I was a little bit disappointed when I got the bike. It was a cheap Coles variety or something, Woolies or Myers or something. However, I rode that then happily for another 2 or 3 years down to the high school and back each day.
And when you were at high school, what sort of ambitions or plans did you have for the future?
When I first went to the high school, I was put in the third of the four classes in the form, the original form, or year. And at the end of first term, I got promoted up to the top level. I think the high school didn't have a high opinion of the Wales Street School I'd been at as a junior. And I was heading to profession. I had medicine in my mind. And I thought I was going along pretty well until after the second year, and my parents decided the best thing I could do was leave and join the public service at the age of 14. And the headmaster had my mother and I in for an interview when this had been suggested, and tried to talk me into continuing with a professional education of some sort, but my mother was adamant, saying, no, he's got to get into the public service. So that was the end of that. So I only had the 2 years at high school.
Was this a common?
Yes, yes.
Do you wish that you'd stayed, or?
Well, if I hadn't had my Air Force career, probably, but occasionally it enters my mind. But.
And well, tell me about the ways that you went about getting into the public service.
Well, there was this examination for entry as a telegraph messenger, a public examination. And one of my neighbours, a fellow called Jack Goodrich, was already working for the Postmaster General's Department, and he gave me some tutoring for the examination. But it was a public examination you had to pass to get in as a telegraph messenger.
What sort of questions in the examination?
Oh, I think it was just English, maths and something else. Yeah, pretty straightforward.
And you took the exam and?
Yes, got in.
And where were you to be working, and where were you going to be based, and
Well, for a start, while I was waiting entry, and it was a matter of having passed the examination and then waited until you were invited to come and join them, I did get a temporary job as a telegraph messenger at Russell Street in Melbourne, in the northern edge of Melbourne, little post office there. And we delivered telegrams out around East Melbourne and the northern side of the city on bicycles. And I remember being a little naive because when I first started riding a bicycle through the city of Melbourne, there were no traffic lights in those days. There were policemen on the corners, stop and go. And I thought it was appropriate to turn left and go with the traffic when the policeman had the traffic going across. And the policeman just let me do it until one of the other messengers saw me and said, you can't do that. You've got to wait until the traffic's going straight ahead to turn left. But that worked out all right.
And so tell me about this work that you were doing at Russell Street.
It was a matter of the telegrams being received by the staff of the post office. They came through in a Morse code system, the sounding Morse code, a little bit different to the later ones. It was a clickety-clackety sort of Morse code. Then they were sorted out into sort of districts, and I think there were three or four telegraph messengers there, and we'd go out sometimes with four or five telegrams and just find our way around delivering them. Nothing else too exciting there.
Would you know what the content of the telegrams were?
Yes, we'd see most of them.
What sort of things at Russell Street?
Well, it was just routine business in those days. Sometimes they'd be relating to business for the businesses around the northern end of Melbourne. Sometimes just cheery greetings. Telegrams were infrequent use in those days.
And what would someone's reaction be when you knocked on the door with a telegram?
Oh, politeness, no trouble.
Any sort of excitement or surprise? Or?
No, not at that stage. I suppose I could say that it was part of Melbourne in those days, had a, maybe it still has, a, was not a very good area. I suppose I'd be frank and say there were brothels in the area. And that was a bit upsetting in a way. But never mind.
And what sort of changes did this sort of having a job and not being at school anymore, what sort of changes did this bring to the way you lived your life?
Not too much. I don't think there were any significant changes. I used to meet my same friends at weekends and for skating and camping and so on. But after less than a year of being at Russell Street, or only 6 months, I think, I got my appointment to the Postmaster General's Department and became a telegraph messenger over at Ivanhoe, a northern suburb of Melbourne. And by this time, the war had started. And that's when I did get a shock because there were casualty telegrams going out, which we delivered to families, and that was a bit of a shock for a little telegraph messenger to go along with to some family and say their son was killed or badly wounded. Rather, I thought there must have been a better way of doing it than that.
Well, tell me about when you heard the declaration of war.
I'm afraid, to be honest, it didn't really impact on me too much then as a kid. No.
Do you remember any sort of discussion in the family or at work or?
Only about, which service are you going to enter? Which one are you going to go for? And I suppose that's when I made up my mind about the Air Force.
Did you have an interest? What was your interest in flying or the Air Force?
Oh, I suppose it started where we lived in Thornbury, in that an older brother, one of our group, was already a cadet at Point Cook. This was pre-war. And he used to come home and tell stories about his experiences in the Air Force. I can remember at one stage he brought home machine gun rounds that had been fired into the stop butts they had there and things like that. Although one story I've told in more recent times was along these lines, that he said that as a cadet he had to travel first class on trains, and he wasn't allowed to travel on trams because they didn't have a first class. But I don't know, I think he might have been kidding us a bit. And then there was another, oh, I know, my father, for some reason, I don't remember, he took me over to Essendon in those, just about pre-war, to look at the aircraft flying and so on. And I can remember, I think it was an early version of the Dakota, the DC-2, being taxied around in the mud there, and I reached the conclusion that there's no way you could drive a car through there, but this aircraft was being taxied through it. But there were little things like that I found interesting.
And, I mean, your job was changing at the time as well, but do you remember any changes around Melbourne in general to the lifestyle once the war started in the early years?
Clothing was one, rationing. We just couldn't go and buy clothes. We had to have ration coupons to get clothes. Some foods were scarce. I think there was a limit on meat, if I remember rightly. So there was rationing that had a little bit of an impact.
And what did you feel about who Australia was fighting, what Australia was fighting for?
I'd have to be honest and say no, I didn't. It's not something that entered my mind, no.
And was it, you mentioned that you'd say, you know, what force are you going to join? Was it just a given that when you were old enough you'd...
Yes, there was a call-up system into the Army. And if you wanted to join the Air Force, you had to take your own initiative and set about it.
And do you remember the first time that you had to deliver a telegram with bad news?
Yes, I do. Yes, in Ivanhoe. Mm.
Can you tell me about?
Oh, not really. It was a look of horror on the faces of the people. There's nothing we could say or do to help. But it was just a bit of a shock.
Do you remember what the telegram said?
Oh, you know, the formally worded things. It's, you know, it's with deep regret that we, the so-and-so, have to inform you that your son Richard was killed in action or something like that.
And so what would you do when you knocked on the door? How would you...?
Just hand the telegram over quietly, I think.
Did you have any sort of thing that you would... anything you'd say, any...?
No, not really.
Did anyone ever react badly to you?
No, not in my hearing, no.
Just pause there for a second because we're reaching the end of this tape. So.